KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is in Willamette Week's 2020 Give Guide. Donate at least $10 to KBOO through the Give Guide, and you will receive the Chinook Book mobile app, giving you access to hundreds of coupons to a wide variety of local businesses. You'll also get a few other goodies. Thanks to a very generous donor, all new and increased donations to KBOO through the Give Guide will be matched up to $25,000. The Give Guide and these offers end really, really late on December 31st, so donate today at kboo.fm/give.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of Holding the Thin Green Line. This documentary slideshow tells the stories of people fighting to save the souls of their communities and preserve the integrity of the Pacific Northwest as they fight to stop the world's largest methanol refinery from being built in Conemaugh, Washington, and a massive LNG facility in Tacoma. From December 6th to the 11th, the slideshow can be viewed at your own convenience at kboo.fm/greenline. Then on December 11th from 5 to 6 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with activists who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's Holding the Thin Green Line documentary slideshow screening, December 6th to the 11th, and a live Zoom Q&A on December 11th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now. We're recording this in the aftermath of the election, so I want to give a shout out to our postal service, which safely delivered millions of ballots across the nation, and of course our election officials and ballot counters who worked tirelessly to bring in this result. What an awesome crew. Give them a hand. KBOO needs your help, as always. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give or kboo.fm/donate. There's also a donate button. Just to remind you, KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We know times are hard. A lot of people are facing financial hardships, but every little bit helps, so donate whatever you can for the radio station you know and love online at kboo.fm/give. Keep us on the air. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. And I do have a guest this month, but before I get to my guest, I'm going to read a couple of poems by Cedar Saigo. Cedar Saigo is a Squamish poet. He was raised on the Squamish Reservation near Seattle, Washington. As a Portlander, we'll try and keep the sibling rivalry out of this for now. He studied writing and poetics at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa Institute, and he's the author of Selected Writings, Death Race, VSOP, and Expensive Magic, Stranger in Town, Language Arts, and Royals. He's also the editor of There You Are, Interviews, Journals, and Ephemera by Joanne Kiger. And I'm going to read two poems by Cedar Saigo. The first is titled After Self-Help. All my rooms are alien. Towers of books tilt and crumble at the least extended breath. A matinee beyond recall. Brown birds, pale-breasted, darting through, too late, hello, later. Kiss the lights and they change out over the stardust. Cities are huge machines for sorting poets, skating down the cellophane and folded hills. Even cast-off lines have their own pull and rhyme. Man at leisure ripped out of my mind, lonesome after mine own kind, hot black, soft white, warm reds. Mine a thinking man's cartoon western. Mine the one who enters the stories. mine the evergreen tears brushed with coral. The boat in the box is mine, and mine the full sky. That's After Self-Help by Cedar Saigo. Now I'm going to read a poem by him titled A Small Secluded Valley. Your portraits are all thin Indians, half their faces edging out the fog, where sparks rain onto our temple, where I enter to write the names of my poems for the night, daybreak, star, and the sun, both of which I never got around to. For want of love and allegiance in every second, my regrets you interrupted, offset in the kind light as a crown. Evans walking around sounds behind a closed door. Nice to see you, to walk a bit and stop as on a river, its lava shut under in a tunnel of love. Regardless, the visions hike up overnight and flames trail off like the finest spider's thread slipping my mind. And that was A Small Secluded Valley by Cedar Saigo. And now I'd like to introduce my guest for this month, Ken Yoshikawa. Ken Yoshikawa is a half Japanese, third culture American poet actor from Portland, Oregon. He's been active in the Portland spoken word community since 2014. In his theater career, he's appeared at Artists Rep Theater, Portland Center Stage, Northwest Children's Theater, Oregon Adventure Theater, and Portland Playhouse. In a word, the works. In 2019, he released his first spoken word album, Quiver, from Lightship Press, and performed his autobiographical poetic solo play, The Art of Fly Swatting, at the Pan Asian Repertory off-Broadway in New York City. And his poems have appeared in Nailed Magazine, Letters from the Void, Hoppa Mag, and Discover Nikkei. And his first full-length poetry book, Monster Colored Glasses, is out now on Lightship Press. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Teal, for having me on the show.
So we'd like to hear some of your poetry now.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I'm going to read, starting from the book, Monster Colored Glasses. I'm just going to read the first few poems and then a couple others later on.
Sounds good.
There is a turtle ferrying a box. Inside the box is a bank run by small gods. The turtle swims back and forth across an ocean. It lands on a beach. People come to the beach and place their treasure beside other people's treasure, knowing the treasure will be forgotten, knowing it is what they love, but also what they must protect. Some have placed their photographs, their daggers. There are rain clouds and lucky pennies. There is a fiddle cradling a mug of tea. Some people even placed themselves into the box, curled in the seeds of a pomegranate, but not their gold. The turtle says, "This box is bigger than the ocean, but I cannot carry gold. I will become too small, and something big out here will eat me. You must carry your own gold. You must carry your own gold." Nagai means long, like a flight from here to Tokyo, like the ooze of a ghost. Nagaiki means long life. Nagaame means long spell of rain, which to me may as well be home. The I in Nagai is the dictionary form of the unconjugated adjective. Hiroi means wide, like a turtle shell, like the audience of a well-made film. Hiroba means plaza. Hiroba kyofusho means agoraphobia. It's a wild world indeed. Dear Hollywood, I wonder if you know this. I wonder what with cowboys drawing colts, knights slaying no goods, spies harboring secrets, or pirates stealing pearls. Watching them roll, I seem to think you do. Now if nagasode means long sleeve, then hirosode means, I think you're catching on, a place to keep your aces. So you know Nagasaki means long cape, right? Like a bitty peninsula. And Hiroshima means wide island. It speaks much for itself. There is an order you must understand before you can make language dance. That doesn't have to matter, right? We can say Nagasaki means long ago, means half-life, means forgotten, means rad, means long point, means stick it and roast it. I mean, I think you know what it means to stretch anything until the meaning changes. You know Hiroshima means follow the light, means pretty skies, means mushroom spaghetti all over your pants, means relieve your shadow of its body. But that's between you and me in this space. It's a wild world because there's order, because more than words actually tear when they're pulled the wrong way. When you give a child a hero and then you take it away and you change it, worlds break in ways that make not a single sound. You seem to put scars where they don't much belong. It's okay, we can carry the weight, but the joke is still on you, because Nagasaki means magic man, but Hiroshima still means a broken heart. So do your magic then. Take a mold of our face and throw it away. Take a scalpel, strap it to a white curse. I mean a white cursor. Whip it in a bending confuser bro cam. I mean a rendering computer program. Photoshop your way through the mouse maze, getting lost for cheese in the complex of raise down, erase, and spray paint. Color my house white, please. Color my house white, please. Pick the locks with CG. Fix the bones in our face. Please, wait, no, let us try. Hiroshima is a wide-eyed pika pika hodai of wa are sore kawaii na kakkoii na. Nagasaki no longer means long eyes but long nose. Hiroshima not wide nose but wide eyes. Let me introduce you to the beautiful ghosts of two deleted cities, Nagashima and Hirosaki, where haunted by defeat from military superiority, that we see the white victors not only stronger than us, more wealthy and intelligent, more beautiful than us, they're actually better than us. The best way to reinforce supremacy is to have our enemies defeat themselves and forget why they're doing it. So, Scarlett Johansson, you are exactly the Japanese woman Japan has been waiting to become. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It has been too long. The work too long. We can actually be you now, but you can't speak the language. Easy fix. They will take your fancy images, remove your voice, make you silent, then put Japanese words, Japanese souls, Japanese ghosts back into the shell they built to get over our annihilated lessons in humility. But what about me? Am I the now unaccepted byproduct of a loser's complex in a global world with wide eyes, long nose, Japanese words, and a US passport? Nagasaki could mean long precedent, but hey, I can stretch anything to change its meaning. Nagasaki now means long game, means we're coming back for what is ours, means you are running out of excuses, Hollywood. Hiroshima means the bombshell bombed this one, means cheap thrills have high costs, means sex sells, tried to sell, means you couldn't sell our childhood dreams back to us because you cannot take for keeps that which was never yours. I mean, you just seem to break what you do not understand. The magic man in Dabbleland will wreck himself the most. Remember now, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Not I, no, Hollywood. I thought you understood. I am the little boy coming home, split, hungry for a hard-boiled egg in the fallout. You are the ghost in the shell of a very fat man falling, falling, falling. I wonder what I would ask my Japanese grandma, my obachan, if she were here, having been an American citizen 76 years ago. She wasn't. She was in Japan. But I wonder. I wonder how different she would be if she spoke English. I guess she wouldn't speak Japanese, so neither would I. I don't like that. But I think I'd ask her, and maybe only once, what did they take? Not why did they take it, we already know that, but what? What toys did you play with? What color was your blanket? And even if she knew English with an MA in education, I don't think she'd open up. It's already like that with us. When I call her, not much is said except whether I'm genki, ganbatteru, and eating enough. So I wonder, because I can, what if her mother, my great-grandma, my hibachan, had the perfect rolling mat for makizushi, and that with it, she could steamroll the whole neighborhood, all the houses and the four-door Fords and Studebakers. They'd be fire hydrants bundled with knives, pomade, pastel, fences, and salmon. I bet she could make sushi with a moving train. It'd be spinning in a loop inside, I bet. I bet she could roll this land from coast to coast. Oregon roll, California roll, Rocky Mountain roll. You're not in Kansas any roll. Welcome to Tule Lake roll, Minidoka roll, the Roll of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Statue of Roll, Birdie Mount, Rollshmore, Rollless Island, Pearl Harbor. I imagine she would say yes. In fact, because she and her mother were such secret Asians, had such a role in the war effort against the United States of America, that sushi roller was exactly what they took from them. As well they should, because it's clear my hiba-chan feeding her babies could prove to be a national disaster. So this next poem, it shifts gears away from like family and heritage and moves more into things that happened in my young adulthood. It involves, I guess, a content warning for abuse and a content warning for suicide ideation. And yeah, and this is kind of changes the corner in the book. It keeps going, so yeah. What if the energy required to accept yourself exactly the way you are equates precisely to that needed to change for the better? Say this includes your cowardice, the hours still spent drowning in the broken sluice of your emotions, not a truce, without a notion that the daybreak deluge can be tapped, without assumption, understood without compunction, standing tall without defensiveness, no less the sense when your confidence got shaken and undressed to serve another's spiritual ends, to buff his spiritual lens. Finally, he said, something you are good for. When he told you to dance, and you did, jigging to the sense of who you know yourself to be, dislodged itself, then floating in an empty narrative, your eyes tied down by repetitive imperatives as prayer hit your heart beat like a sacramental sedative, more spiritual phrases out of context of their heritage, you were clawing for a culture, but really just afraid to live, afraid to grow your own, afraid to own the potholes in the road up to your home, because you were made of light. Right? There's no room for fear. When you are made of love and beauty, perfect, like a sphere, there is never need to fight, right? Your heart is in the clear. Surely you are holy, or you're wholly insincere. That's what you think, since you hid behind a veil. I want to know your bravery, but you're afraid to fail, so you wither down the spiral. Unable to answer wisely all the viral whys behind this guise of feeling sorry for yourself, of needing someone else to tell you how to live your life, to play your part and pay blood tithes in space he made sacred, but twisted to mean what took place you intended. No wonder you lost your way. No wonder I lost myself. The moment came when the body from whose blood he drew was no longer me, but the you I'm speaking to. So when he told me to sing and be free, I couldn't. Was caught like a bowshot doe in the throat. These wounds that don't bleed sound like no's, never said. I had love songs for death, but no postage to send. So when I told him I wanted to kill myself and he said he would help, was he calling a bluff or had he already killed me? Weakness, I can speak to this, the doubts that I conceal, while acknowledging reality, regardless how it feels, to say that it's okay to be afraid, or if you stall, you gain all the momentum used to rise up when you fall. I'll understand if you go quiet, speaking not a word. There is no hope to force you into happy. That's absurd.
And so relevant to that, you know, there are several poems in Quiver that address this experience from what I could tell, and also your solo play, The Art of Fly Swatting. Do you feel able to give a little bit of the background on that whole story?
Yeah, sure. That story is one of it's a story of abuse. It's a story of a young man, me, who absent of his like father, like so many people in our culture and across the world in many ways, seeking a father figure, found one, and while in many ways it was idyllic for quite a few years, it turned and became pretty grossly abusive in emotional, spiritual ways, and in like sexual ways too. And And it's all confused with, like, you know, my own path and my own for discovering my own sexuality. And it has a lot to do with, you know, because I'm queer, and it's, I guess, coming to terms with that. And honestly, he was a part of that process. But and he was an older man. So it's like, yeah, yeah. And like, there's kind of a trend of, you know, young queer people. I hear a lot about young queer men and older queer men who take advantage of them. That's mm-hmm. But I can only really speak from my own experience. And it was pretty gross. You still learn things, and it becomes, you know, obviously feel for art, which is the only thing I knew what to do with it.
Right. And do you feel that the so you allude in some of your other poems to kind of a sense of cultural dislocation? Do you feel that that played into the abuse situation?
Well, it's funny. This man, he's white. He gave me a name, and the name is Kenji Moto. And it's a really weird name. And then I went by that name for quite a few years in college. And so he kind of fit a piece that was obviously missing. My mom is white and lovely woman, right? But was unable to, like, you know, help me ground into my Asian identity, right? And here comes this white guy who's like, I honor you for your culture. In fact, I'm going to, like, give you this nickname, and it's going to fit this piece, which you believe, you know. But really what he was doing is dislodging things that ought to be there instead. And names are powerful. Names are absolutely powerful. And that was the kind of the core arc of my solo show that I took to New York, which is the story of my name, which my name really is just Ken. It's not short for anything. And mm-hmm. it's English and Japanese. And it's whenever people try to call me Kenny or, like, you know, anything like that, I'm like, no, that's not my name. And if it wasn't for that experience, maybe I'd be a little more lenient. But now I'm just like, no, this is my name. Respect, you know.
A white man dubbed me Kenji Moto-san. Ere first we met, a firmless kid, I swift embarked with his delusive marathon. His slaver's heart, full insecure, I'd lift and validate by not confronting. Fool, I played his Asian leprechaun. I charged his power plant of Babylon, his tool collected, surely sharpened by his enlarged cruel sense of truth. He'd weld the nails, ham me in the calves, affix my will to doubt in silence, by ill wisdom hypnocrammed. Long gone, I see since fate had pulled me out. He of true power was a parody. My name is Ken, and it means clarity.
I have another poem, actually, that kind of deals with, like, the aftermath. Like, a lot of this book, Monster Colored Glasses, is about the aftermath of all that, and it's how I processed it. Of course, I deal with what it was like in it, but all of that was done in context of looking back. And this next poem, it involves a lot of, actually, kind of like a more of a character and a performance as an actor. It's kind of where one of the poems where a lot of my my crafts combine. So it's a little bit weird. It's also very, very bilingual, and it's not meant to be necessarily understood. There's two words that I'll translate at the beginning. One, the first one is the word obake. Obake means monster, or, like, you know, ghost or specter. It's like some kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the second word is gaijin, which happens later in the poem. And the word gaijin from in Japanese means foreigner, like, you know, yeah. Most specifically to do with people coming to Japan, but, like, it doesn't matter if you're gaijin in America if you're foreign. But that's a really complicated question. But here we go. Anyways, this poem is called How to Speak Obake, or in other words, How to Speak Monster.
Warui kimi ore nigai kusai uzai onyami kunyami kanari kemuri bakkari da na kanji no himitsu no oniyomikata anata no baka no baketsu no nakami wa nan desu ka ba 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 aitsu koitsu 起立キモイレおはようございます。大バカお化けの小僧がさ、ズグズグコロコロカッパになった。雷キャンディ噛みながらカラカラコワゴワ心を閉じた。あらららららららららららららら、ブブブバッド。 It's gotta be bad where you be, ghetto. I mean, you gotta be bad, ghetto. No, you gotta have been bad too. Gotta catch fire to eat it and keep it. もう決めて綺麗に切れてくれて調子がいいな。 Can you kill me with air, with distance? Ignore how this hungry hand fits the back of your head. Did you know your eyes can leave your body, that I can spook them right out of their sockets, watch them scram under the bed? Well, if your bed is on the ground, can I eat them? It's dangerous out there. Keep four island curses from the rising sun in your back pocket. Kono yaro. It's okay, you got my check mark. Kono kusutare. Yeah, I know you just love this shit, right? Bakamono. So then you just stick them in the fulcrum, right? Gotta make me feel each tidbit. Gotta really believe it. Kutabare kono inpo. You don't need to understand it. Just say it with me. Hakujin janai. Hakujin janai. Nihonjin janai. Ninjin janai. Chimamire hanjin ippon dake. Chimamire hanju ippon bake. I know you know the casual racism of good people. Give up. You don't even try to hide it. Admit it. Because that's not how you speak, monster. Human. See, I know this woman. She's got no face, and even she looks both ways before joining you in bed. I know this little girl in a TV just wants a little hug and to kill you, but you didn't give her much of a choice. And I know this dude with brown skin and a brown familia, and he's quite sweet. I don't know why you keep throwing him at me. I can't feed him, you know? You gotta see, there is a difference between not having a reflection in the mirror and not wanting to look at it. It takes one to know one, and you are not like us. See them? I made them. Their hair pouring out like ink on a brick wall. You break them and send them right in our direction, and we kintsugi them another chance. Show them how to feed themselves in your unforgiving world. But that's not how this is supposed to work. This is survival 101. A classroom should never have a hospital or a graveyard. All you see in our bits and pieces is adventure, isn't it? Farming the limbs of my family for gold and experience. I mean, the very fact that we exist somewhere in this world, you just can't take it, can you? So you gotta come into my cave, my home, and find whatever it is you lost in my blood. Is that it? Is this it? Is this where you can finally see yourself? How too few will never not be gaijin in America. It takes one to know one. And you are so like us. Did you really think you were the only ones living in between? Did you really think you'd be released from not belonging? Once it has you, there's no stake in the heart can kill it. Only stories and dark forests. There are demons in the mountain stones. Yama o noroya. And even they know you don't own the rock you stand on. So fine, if you really need to know, then tell them that their house is haunted and pull down your eyelid. Stick out your tongue, meh. Tell them they're different, that you don't know them, and don't bow back. Dishonor them by walking through their house with muddy shoes. And yet, in the end, that's still not how you speak, Obake, human. All you have to do is say that you're hungry. So, yeah, that's a poem about othering. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and so the book passes through that, the trauma, and then it moves later. And, like, because then there's a relationship with my father, and here we go. Here's daddy poems.
Okay.
Here's one at least. This is called An Ode to My Father's Neckties. 1. Musubikata. The way to tie a father to his son. These roadways of inheritance. These dusty pulse keepers nobly slept in a mahogany cabinet at my grandparents' home. They are London, Melbourne, Milan, and Grand Rapids. They are Paris and Nagoya, Amsterdam, and home. Multichromatic elephants and polka dots. Take 20, 30, he said, with gently demanding generosity. Maybe each time I tie one for an interview or for a wedding, I'll learn to tie the clouds together, dress fancy the Pacific, connect his mirror to my mirror. Ni, kakkoi. Wrap it twice around the knot so you remember. Keep the front just long enough so you remember. Master that dimple just below the knot so you remember. Yes, no, wait, here, like that. Hai, iyo. San, tadashii. I stuffed probably 18 ties into a plastic bag. Now, what the hell am I gonna do with 18 ties? Can they tie the years I didn't see him to the moment I looked him in the eyes to thank him? He gave me shoes, a French black coat, bought me a navy blue suit, but when he saw the condition which I'd subjected the ties to, I realized I didn't really want the ties, only the instruction for how to take care of them. Please, Dad, show me a way to not stuff my life into a plastic bag. Show me how to dress so sharp it cuts a wormhole to the sun. Is this the right way? Are these ties your wormhole to me? Yon, nani o shimashou? He told me there has to be distance between two people for there to be a conversation. That if you ask someone directly what they want, in Japanese it ends up being rude and invasive. I'm so used to being on the other end of your tie that now that we're together, looking through the very same mirror, I'm living on the black stripes printed on your thin end, that much closer, only for today. I will never be you, Dad, but I'm fixing my collar, Dad. I remember everything. Otosan, look, I did it. Look, I did it. Dad, I'm just like you. Go, kanpeki. I've decided when I leave, I'll tie each tie to the wings of the airplane and watch them flutter from the window seat.
That's a really nice image.
Thank you. I think I have two more poems from the book, and then I'll read some other things from other places.
Okay.
Maybe we'll return here. So yeah, this poem's also about masculinity and it's all confusing gender and stuff. So it's, all right, this is called Still Part of the Problem. I'm writing a poem about being a man. I'm writing a poem about being a man. I'm writing a poem about being a man. I'm rewiring a man, becoming a poem. I'm manning the console. I'm robot. I program. I'm hammer on blueprints on iron. I'm a nice thing. I'm a good man. Good man. This good, good man. I'm a boost tech and the boss. Bow beast. I'm repoeming a wire to write a man. These are my rights. I have only half a face. I'm tapping Morse code emotions. Do you even read? Do you even lift meaning from mystery? I'm howling for the solder. This is my element. Top 10. I thought you heard answers through a wet blanket. I thought you knew comparisons were a shout out. We've learned the best way to fight gravity is to point fire at it. I'm pouring wine on the ram's head to fan its might. I'm pining for Valhalla. My hand is for lunch. Watch me wrap my head around the universe. Call me actual. I am so damn real. I see you see me and the countdown. See, Stargazer, these feet are millennia. Watch me get this right. With my eyes in the clouds, I stuck the mountain in my eyes and got a story. Do you trust words enough to be remembered? Did you remember what words referenced the fire? Do you still carry burn marks from that day back when it was a liftoff, it was a runaway, it was one or the other? Can you trust your memory to be a dictionary? Can you forgive the dictionary you were given? Can you trust your bones to be foundation? What does it even mean to be secure? I'm all wrong around the past, on my manners, while my future was a space station. And when I make it past the Oort cloud, my shadow will not stand. It will not matter, won't be my chaser. I'll be out there, floating as a little light. And I hope it guides you out of your castle to the sea. I was that stone you picked up along the way. I know you threw it into the water, so I know you know some love is not for following. But if you do, don't hold your breath for me. Send me an invitation. I'll send you a question. Don't answer it. send back a better one. Trust this distance to build us a radio. Departing woebegone with a beacon, prying more time out of mana, out of this gender, out of shame, still praying poetry can turn a phantom, still coaxing verbs into their action, still riding my fist into a rocket ship. I'm waking gale force in an obelisk, still part of the problem, no matter how far, directions and control, my very own constellation, really, don't come, I don't need your help, I'm a man, I'm writing, I'm a legend, I don't exist, I'm perfect, believe in me, write me alive, write a poem, man, about me being. Ultimately, I would like to say the book has a happy ending, and maybe I'll read two more. They're shorter.
Okay.
So this one's called Quiver. Quiver, for the moonlight in our palm lines, a library of star signs, a chamber full of salt remembers each kindness while true faults make maps for lost pilots who forgot how to stop, not to hear and respond, but to listen and bond, that there's less at the top, but more in the silence. Take good note and file it, but more than just save it, to savor the feedback is lilacs, to lay lines aligned by the facts, hold back what reacts. When loss becomes labor, charm demons with violence to vapor. No matter what's happened, remember there's still air here. No hope is vanity once put to action. Even if it's breathing, the physics remains the same in any language. Yumemi yumiya, aijo yokeruna. 今日の鏡の画面を我慢より空気の甘さに合わせ破ってもよろしい君が十分見ろ山の横にある200個の雲神その優しい嵐あるこの悲しみ洗うため。So let it. I'm talking in my sleep because my heart speaks Japanese and I believe in you like I believe in gravity, which means I don't understand, but I know you're there to watch my step, though I may still fall, but your soft eyes accelerate, no problem at all, and I wake right next to you with a quiver full of moonlight and my gratitude. Arigatai. Good morning. And I've been more interested in love poems, at least after I wrote at least this book. And mm-hmm. I fell in love, and while that my partner of or ex-partner technically moved off to do grad school and do all these amazing things, and I'm super proud of them. We're still really good friends and all that, but the point is, I'm really grateful for them. Anyway, shout out, thank you, Sarah. Here we go, this is obviously is for you. Time's electric dandelion. This place, I've been here before, but not yet with you. This cave, watching kids hopping over holes, tossing highlighter gum into the crevice of time's dredged minerals. Should all this come crumbling behind us and leave us interred under the tick-tock of this high-walled tube, would we find ghosts with wide, wide grins? Would the shy giant down here finally feel safe enough to peek around the corner? We're counting down from 10 with the lights out, watching in a drop of water all the calcium, all the days, all the taps of our feet, the walls rolling lithium into golden fields, sunshine bell kicks, flowers blooming from the ions in the periodic table, hankering for the comfort of our brief silhouette holding hands. We can say we've kissed in total darkness, can say we blew to a stop the dandelion clock, can say this place has known a brief sight of liquid quartz, the sound of wanting, a light of deeper linings being carved where once lived only stone. Time and the breathing of the underworld has seen a tiny flying seed. That kind of does it for the book for now, I think. It's a good, like, through line, I guess. There's a few through
lines. That's a great poem to end on, actually. You do have some more recent work, but I'd like to ask you a couple of interview-type questions first.
Oh, yeah,
if you
let's
don't
go.
Mind. So in your biography, you refer to yourself as third culture. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, sure. So third culture effectively means you are raised in a country that isn't the culture that you were technically born into. And that, what that means is that I was born into, you know, being Japanese, and my dad's Japanese. He's not American, he's Japanese. And my parents split when I was in like third, fourth grade. My mom brought me here, my dad went back to Japan. So I was raised in America. And I guess being away from, you know, like being away from Japan, and while still identifying as Japanese, and there's I have a really complicated relationship with my identity with being Japanese, because Japan is like historically an imperialist nation, and there's deep patriarchy and racism in that country, and there's some serious ghosts, and I don't mean to victimize Japan in my poetry, saying that they're like, you know, the victim to America, but like so, and as a third culture kid growing up here, I guess I did whatever I could to own it. My dad gave me truthfully a really wonderful gift, which was the Japanese language, and and that has been my tether to that culture. And I know that a lot of folks who are like, you know, who were his families were incarcerated during World War II in concentration camps. They were stripped of their language, the camps caused a bunch of trauma, and their families wanted to, you know, become model minorities, and which is a deeply racist program and white supremacist to the core. And so they stripped their kids of their language and didn't teach it because they thought that that would alienate them from American culture. And I mean, they're the victims of white supremacy, pure and simple, and that's really sad. And I know folks who really mourn for that. And it's a very delicate thing. And so as a third culture kid, not classically JA. I'm like technically first generation Japanese American, even though I'm fourth generation Irish Italian. So it's like, it's awkward and strange. But like, I'm still in relationship with, you know, Japanese Americans, or you know, J folks who are third generation, fourth generation, and I've had the honor of playing the Journal of Ben Uchida in the Journal of Ben Uchida at the Oregon Children's Theater, and I got to play this little Japanese kid who was going through incarceration and in World War II and the trauma of that. And it's just an honor to be given that as like, to be trusted with it, even though that isn't like my own personal history. And so I had the guidance of people around me, and, I was accountable to the actual folks who do have that history. And so that was a huge honor and an important moment in my own cultural development, I guess. Yeah. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. So in terms of the language, I think it's a huge gift to be bilingual and to write in both languages. And I wonder, you know, many of your poems, as we've heard, move back and forth freely between Japanese and English. Some writers that I've spoken to say there's a very different headspace for the two languages, and they produce kind of separate poems, separate works. And I wonder if that's the case for you, or if you don't feel that way.
Well, that's a really interesting thing. Yeah. So for me, just to answer your question first, is that there are poems that are just English, right? And I've written maybe one or two poems that are just Japanese, but usually Japanese finds its way into a lot of my poems. I guess the reason why is that I learned Japanese when I was very young. And because of that, I remember being in bed in Amsterdam of all places, and my dad was reading me these like folk tales in Japanese, you know, and like they usually start like mukashi mukashi aru tokoro ni, means just like, it's just a lot like once upon a time, right, in Japanese. And so Japanese carries with it a very innocent, almost infantile emotional structure, and it's very sentimental, very very comfortable. I feel like a kid, and I also, my Japanese causes me to be much more childish, because I never, you know, I the most education I ever got was like up to third grade in Japanese. Mm-hmm. And so that whole portion of my brain is just infantile, and that for me, after the trauma stuff, going back to the Japanese was actually a great way for me to reclaim a lot of my own kind of personal integrity and purity and stuff like that. Yeah, and there was also a period of my time long before that abuser person I talked about a while ago, that where I had internalized white supremacy, and I saw Japanese as being inferior, and I was superior because I was half white, and that's super problematic and very racist and very delusional. And yeah, and so I had to process that, and the work is also about that too. So so as far as language goes, I do like to blend them together, and because that's who I am. But I respect anyone who has like a different experience with their bilingualhood, you know, like absolutely.
So you also, you now have a printed book. You also published an album of spoken word poetry, and you've done a lot of theater kind of performance art. And this is really kind of the same question. Do you see those as different forms? Is there a compartmentalization? Are there things that you feel are different to say versus to write down that someone's going to read?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great question. Okay. So as an actor and a poet, you know, I find that spoken word is the place where those two connect. And is there compartmentalization? I would say slightly. There is, like, you know, my relationship to the page through my hand and through the pen or through the computer and whatever. And then there's the performing of it. And a lot of people I've heard say, oh, Ken, like, when I got to actually hear you say that, that poem made a lot more sense to me. It's like I could hear it through your voice. I know what it means more. And it's like, oh, yeah. And I totally respect that. And I think a lot of these poems are meant to be read aloud. Like, I'm a huge fan of Shakespeare, for instance. At least I grew up with him a lot. And he's an imperialist, whatever. But, like, he's also, you know, the Shakespeare. So it's like, the whole point of it is, Shakespeare, you need to hear out loud. It's meant to be heard out loud. And if you just read it on the page, you're getting like maybe a tenth of the meaning that is there. And everything else is compacted in the visceral experience of as it moves through the body. And I think that's writing is, I think we take for granted that writing is itself a physical exercise. Obviously, so it's performance. And so all those things, eventually, they're all component to something, a bigger project that I'm working on. I know that there's a lot of artists that do it too, and as spoken word poets. And then also I'm a playwright now, and I've been practicing that craft for a year or two. And writing words that other people say is like a whole nother thing. And it's connected, though, you know, it's a new project as well. So
that must be a little frightening. I know as a poet, every poet has the experience of having someone read their poem and come away with something like totally different. Like, how did you even possibly get that out of what I wrote? And to put those words in the hands of someone else to speak, and someone else, you know, the director may have a different vision than what you do. You know, how do you trust that those words are going to go out there and not be completely transformed into something you would never have intended?
Well, you know, there's, I
guess.
Or
is that okay?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that, like, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, everyone has their own subjective experience, and these words are a kind of code. You know, every poem to me is a kind of code, but we're much more complex than computers. And so it's like when you throw that code through their system, and it might evoke a completely unique response, and that's good. You know, I think that's, you know, everyone hears a certain piece of music, and it's like, you know, there might be a lot of commonalities to the way they receive it, but it means a little bit different, and that's good. I like that a lot, especially with playwriting. I mean, that is, I think it's extraordinarily important that you have a director or an actors and performers who do not see it the way you see it, and they do have some, or at least they have, you know, maybe a part, they're significantly different in their own composition, that they bring something unique to it. And that is vital, absolutely vital. So I do hope people take, you know, there's half of it, which is, what did he mean? And then the other is like, this is what it means to me. And I think those two can live in concert with each other. I think that's why it's beautiful and complicated.
Yeah. So ultimately it's collaborative.
oh my God, yeah, as a theater artist, like the relationship between the performer and the audience is the blood of it. It's like, it's absolutely necessary. Like the, I love being an audience member so much. I used to be like, you know, wanting to be the center of attention, but I've learned that no, audience members, they give so much to the performer. And so it's like, I just, yeah. And so the, what happens between an audience and a performer is just, oh, it gives me so much life. I not in the pandemic, I've really, really missed live theater. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, like live poetry readings, and that energy is what I live for.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are missing a lot of that. So let's hear a few more poems, if you like, from your recent work. And then I have a totally random question to ask you.
Oh, heck yeah, let's go. Okay, so these are like pandemic poems. And so they're actually, more of them are quite shorter. So yeah, here we go. Let's see. Time tackled me right off the path, saying, holy shit, dude, get down. I fell past the roses, through the iron gates, into my dark room. Capitalism is floating in the air out the window, saying, hey, open up, I want you back. But time won't let me go. I say, but you don't exist. You're made up, an imaginary machine that people use to cope with reality because it's terrifying. How do I love you? Well, dude, time says, pointing out the window, you dated him. Time opens their mouth, tucks me in their cheek where it's dark and warm, and there are video games, all the books I bought but haven't read yet, where eventually it smells like farts and traffic is calming out the window because someone still has to be somewhere. The silence is now the sound of people listening to the sound of people dying far away or in the bedroom. Time closes its mouth and tongues me. And I'll just kind of go through these one at a time. The days are hope. The hope is gray. The gray is slipping. The fall is flat. The sheet is square, and I tear them into little statues who also tear littler sheets into littler statues who've lived months before the end of the phrase. What is an ocean without water but a word in a valley that claws its way out of its hole past the atmosphere and the planet to burn itself forgotten in the belly of the sun? I can be wool in the evening and feathers in the morning. I need not suffer to be beautiful. Between the duck and its ripples, a fair pond sits, no tears squeezed or denied. Swaddled in dried rose, hunkered by bees, I can be sighed and talked of with love or not. Love can find me in the same chair every day, and when it hurts, I can spin average, steep, yet shed no grace. Beautiful can furlough the moment to sand. I can lose sand in all sand, forgetting oceans in the shower for a time. The dirt eats a pool of ink. There are mushrooms sprouting there. There is a shiver in my skin. I give it, felt, to the walls, and it sleeps a sleep of walls, not blue in the face, nor feathers by forceps, but a glass figure on the mantle, gold pouring through the window. This smile, not a smile. Yes, it too will fade. And the sun that moves is yet the sun, and yet the sun, and yet. I am water. You are water. These days are ocean. Waves aren't waves. Waves are ocean. So blood is ocean. Teeth and oars. I've always been an eater of eaters. Hoarding shame, the birds can smell and circle hungry. They can't find me. I am water, same, our shame, mine too, this rage, one dream, all overlapping these days. What is an iceberg but a clenched fist? What is a cloud but a river too but a lake? And what's a cloud but someday blood, and certainly ocean, waves, everywhere, together, one storm. Is there a migration, refugee water, seeking comfort? Are we coming to land? Are we going together? There was earth beneath us all along.
So, two questions I have left, I guess.
Okay.
What's coming up for you? Where do you see your next year or two creatively?
A lot of theater. I'm really focused on playwriting and theater stuff. Yeah, that's where the majority of my attention is directed. Yes, I mean, obviously, because we're not meeting in cafes and stuff like that, and poetry for me means something different. Just, you know, and I also definitely want to not forget to I definitely want to remember the big shout out to, for my book specifically, to Lightship Press and Igor Brezhnev and Sam Preminger, who did the, you know, Sam was my editor, Igor was my designer and publisher, and also Connor Choi, who did the art. I just want to give huge shout outs to those three folks. So grateful, and to everyone who has, you know, helped in the production of that book. I'm so grateful. I just want to say that before, in case I forget, but for the next year and a half, I'm focused on theater a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there any prospects for live performance? Nobody knows,
I
really.
Wish. Yeah, and probably nothing until fall of 2021. I'm guessing, because, you know, the mismanagement of COVID has made it absolutely impossible and dangerous for us to do things in public in a way that we would really want. But that just means that there's a lot of time for us to develop new work. And that's what's happening a lot. And at least the places that I'm connected to, and like being able to read with some folks. And yeah.
So here's the completely random question. What's all the right. place you've always wanted to visit and why?
Oh, crap. Well, I'm, these kinds of questions stump me so much because I never really know where I need to be or want to be until I just somehow get there, you know, like, and I'm like, oh, I don't presume to know what, like, which I could say things that I, oh, that'd be nice. But it's like, I guess the place I want to be is in a world without capitalism. Ah, that's it. Yeah.
And why?
Capitalism. Oh, okay. Well, let's have a 20-hour conversation. no, essentially, capitalism is destroying the planet, dehumanizing people, oppressing people, and like it requires at least one or more entire classes of people to be exploited in order to exist, and it needs to create disaster and like complex overlapping, you know, oppressions that in order for it to live. And in doing so, it is steadily and assuredly destroying our environment, which will then destroy us. So like ultimately and assuredly. So yeah, without capitalism, utterly zero, bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
So that's the world we're going to have to build if we want to visit it.
Yes. Yes. And we are. Well, at least I invite you to organize with people in your community to build power and then continue that work, deepen your knowledge, political education. Yeah.
All right. Well, you just heard that from Ken Yoshikawa here on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This has been Wider Window Poetry, and as always, thank you for listening and stay safe.
Thank you.
The starfin eyelid sea monster peers out behind my folded lungs onto the dark. With slippy hands begins the climb from doubt to bold dexterity, but not a mark or clue presents the way. So sits the stare with beady quasars at the shadow's own prosperity, itself of gudgeon care to preen my jejun guttering and groan. What is this pale drudgery to wake into a coward world with parsec hope only to parasite the clock, forsake unknown adventure just to safely mope? But, dearest Gup, you are my favorite heart, my form your reef, the night your work of art.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you know that 80% of KBOO's funding comes from individual supporters? Show your support by donating KBOO on GiveGuide today at www.kboo.fm/give. And thanks for supporting volunteer-powered, community-focused radio.